March 14th, 2015, and this is Karen Brewster, and here again with Morris Morgan, continuing on him telling us about his life and career and his painting and his time at the university and whatever else we end up talking about. So thank you again, Morris. And you wanted to talk a little bit about education.
Well, yes. Historically, both sides of my family, from my grandparents on, have been very interested in education. I might have said this before, but my grandfather Morgan was superintendent of schools in St. Helena Parish.
Yeah, you talked about that.
And my mother's parents were, they had 9 children, and all except one of them went to college, which was quite a feat in those days.
And what days would that have been? What time period? What time period would that have been that your mother and her siblings all went to college?
They would have been around 1900. Mm-hmm. And 1910, along in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially for girls.
Yes.
That was unusual.
And I became interested in university, as I said once before, in finding this old abandoned schoolhouse and learning the acoustics in it and so forth. It intrigued me at that time. I thought it must be wonderful, but I hadn't yet gotten under the yoke of the tyranny that's involved in secondary education. Mm-hmm. But I have had a desire to help the native population in Alaska. Being a geographer, I realized the awful conditions under which circumpolar people live as far as ordinary schools and school days, school buses, and curriculums all fit in. It's very difficult and a very expensive region to carry on good education facilities. Mm-hmm. In my work with the Tenenaw chiefs, I was interested in probably a very practical but no less educational issue than raising vegetables. I encountered some resistance, as you can naturally expect, by introducing some part of a culture that didn't exist before. And I had to explain and give examples of the very good agriculturalists that the Native Americans were, particularly in Mexico, where the irrigation and food for huge populations was raised. They were very good farmers. Mm-hmm. And almost everyone knows of the trilogy of beans and squash and corn. But introducing the gardening, primarily kitchen gardens. A garden to me raises vegetables. Flower gardens are something else. But I ran into acceptance in some areas and rejection in others. But by and large, we were able to raise potatoes over the villages by the tons. prior to this, we're paying, in those days, 65 cents a pound for potatoes that were flown in from Fairbanks. So most of the work in the gardening area was successful. But Dr. Scarlin once told me that you have to work at something like 20 years to get a cultural item introduced. It requires a great deal of follow-up, both educationally and monetarily. But the interior of Alaska has agricultural potentials. Often we go off on the wrong tangents. The barley projects in the Delta region, a good example. We had railroad cars painted with Alaska feeding the world and built silos and shipping areas for barley, and it never worked out. It was not a good thing to start with. It got a lot of land cleared and got a lot of people bulldozers. But beyond this, very little was done. It's one example, a very bad example, of trying to do something in an area that cannot reasonably be done. I bought some farming equipment from a person who had come to Alaska to raise corn. He was from a corn-raising area in the Midwest. And he didn't realize that corn had to have a warm temperature at night in order to mature. So I bought some of his equipment just maybe out of pity, but at any rate, I used some of it. But he went back to Kansas and took up raising corn where corn could be raised. It's possible to raise sweet corn with a great deal of tenderness in our gardens here, but commercially, you can forget it. So some of the things that were possible were not practical.
Right. They might. It's a question of scale.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And climate, things that certain crops require, certain plants will grow just so far north. Mm-hmm. We have some good experiments going with fruit trees over the years, and they are moderately successful. But reality sets in, and if you are to succeed in your enterprises that you introduce, you must know something of the geography. Somehow or another, as a geographer, I get back to that. Mm-hmm. Alaskans aren't the only ones to have experimented with the world. We tried the moldboard plow in the Midwest. It turned up the sod and exposed fertile ground, and it worked until the wind and the sun dried and blew away the topsoil. We had the dust bowls. My wife was raised in an area of northeastern New Mexico that had dust bowls. We may later on get a chance to show you a painting I did regarding dust bowls.
Those big dust storms, is that what you mean? Those big storms with all the dust that blew
yes.
across the open country?
Yes, where there was a tremendous profitability in the beginning. And huge teams moved in first, and then the tractors moved in where huge farming techniques were introduced, acres and acres cultivated instantly, and people profited. This grain went into Chicago and was shipped all over. This area still feeds great portions of the world, but many changes have occurred. We had migrations out of Oklahoma and Kansas and other parts of the Great Plains. People went west. They went to California, and they went to Oregon, Washington, and they weren't accepted in some communities because they were poor. They had little financial backing. And the things that happened in California when the sociologists attempted to help them created problems of their own. But this was an example, again, of one example of how people move into areas and without regard to the final product they're going to produce, they destroy the environment. And this isn't unique to our Dust Bowl. It's happened in Europe, it's happened in Asia, and practically all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, now they're cutting down all the rainforest around the world.
This is one of the reasons that I must preach that people know something about the world. If you don't know something about the world, what do you know something about? And I don't know how damaged our planet is presently, but there's a limit to the abuse that it can endure.
So, can I take you back to when around 1970, is that when you came back to Alaska,
yes.
Louisiana?
Yes.
And how did you end up working for Tanana Chiefs Conference, TCC?
Well, I had the chance to go to work with them to promote the gardening projects. And we shipped out rototillers, fertilizer, seed, and instructions. We worked with the village elders, and I did some work for the University of Alaska, teaching off-campus courses. Taught off-campus courses at Fort Wainwright for their university connections. And I became interested in the routing and the building of pipelines regarding the oil discoveries on the North Slope. When I did my doctoral dissertation research, we knew that there was the petroleum reserve.
The National Petroleum Reserve.
But we weren't any way involved in looking for oil or prospecting for any company. Our work was purely studying the delta, the polygons, the river erosion, the formation of the dunes. The 40-foot dune is quite a mountain on the North Slope.
Yeah. I didn't realize there were dunes. Those are sand dunes?
These are dunes in the delta.
But are they sand, or what's...
They're originally sand dunes. Hmm. The delta is a D shape, and it's great areas barren of vegetation, so that the sand dries and the prevailing winds are out of the northeast. And they blow this sand across the delta because there's no vegetation to slow it down. And it bounds over the dunes, and the vegetation in the dunes early traps it, and it becomes a high place. And this obstructs more sand, and pretty soon, over the centuries, you have a series of dunes who have heights as much as 40 feet.
And those are different from a pingo.
Yes, a pingo is a frozen area that by its expansion rises up and pushes the tundra up with it.
Okay. Because I know there are pingos up there. I didn't know there were sand dunes or old sand dunes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There are other sand dunes further to the west.
Yeah, those I knew about.
Yeah.
And in the No Attack
yeah.
area. Kobuk sand dunes, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you get back to Alaska? Because you were in Louisiana working on your project.
I got real homesick, for one thing. And I came back. I guess the whole time I was in Louisiana, I was, even though I was raised there, I was homesick for Alaska. I've always loved this place. I must have. I've sat here in this same house for 50 years.
Yeah.
And Alaska is a big part of my life. I wished I knew more about it. But it's almost overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may know more about it than other people, because as a geographer, you have such broad understandings.
I did, but still, that to me, it would take a lifetime of study to, and then more.
So did you apply for jobs? Is that how you ended up coming back, or you just came back and got a job once?
I came back and got a job.
And that was with Tanana Chiefs?
Yes. And the university.
Right.
And then the chance came along for someone to lay out a route for Arctic gas.
That was for a pipeline?
It had been a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay over to the Mackenzie Delta. And that project eventually wasn't done, but the contract to lay out the route for the line was given to me. I had barely gotten into the swing of it before they folded. And there was a point at which I wasn't even sure I would be able to get paid. But they did come through with most of what I was out. Mm-hmm. I had hired crew and had bought equipment. But
and that was what year? 19...
Oh, Lordy, I don't remember.
70, somewhere around there?
Yeah.
And we still don't have a gas pipeline.
Not yet.
they're still planning the route.
Well, I don't ever look to see it in my lifetime, being 94.
Yeah.
But I've been waiting for the gas line for ever since it was a possibility.
Yeah. So Tanana Chiefs and the gardening project, was that your idea to do the gardening project, so they hired you? Or they had a project already and they hired you to do the project?
I better think on that. I know I was convinced of kitchen gardens, as I call them.
Mm-hmm.
My youth, we always had one because we ate out of it.
Mm-hmm.
A great portion of our diet was out of our kitchen garden, which we just called a garden.
Right.
And I saw a need and a possibility to raise vegetables in gardens. The interior is ideal for that.
Now, you said there was resistance. What kind of resistance?
It was a cultural thing and one that you'd expect to find. And you don't blame anyone for this. It's just that someone told you you had to change a certain aspect of your culture, and fairly rapidly you would resist it. Most of us would. And so this was a change. But even during the early arrival of the Europeans in Alaska, the gold mining bunch, they grew their own vegetables. In many cases, they had fairly elaborate gardens because there was no other source for healthy foods. There was a period where, after the gold mining pretty well closed down, that only a few people around the interior raised gardens, some in connection with hot springs.
Right. Makes sense.
But the recent interest in gardening and food production locally, by local, such as that, is a good thing. But there was a period in the 60s when the vegetables we got were vegetables they couldn't sell in Seattle. It was a tale that we had. We told that if they couldn't sell it in Seattle, send it on up.
So the ones in the grocery store here were pretty...
They were pretty mushy.
Yeah.
Fruit particularly, you pick a pear up, your thumb would go into it, and it was something I don't doubt that drove people to want to make a pear tree grow here.
Yeah.
But they have to take into account where we are, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no escaping the reality of geography. We have long days and nights, and it's strange to us, but there's a reason for it, and it's a very simple thing. The differential bisection of the parallels by the circle of illumination, and because of the tilt of the earth on its axis and its rotation around the sun, we have an extreme seasonality, so to speak, and we have happy lights that we light up, and the darkness of the winter to keep us from having a deficiency. I wrote a short paper with Dr. Taylor years and years ago in the 60s regarding SAD.
Seasonal affective disorder.
Yes. My job was to simply put out the mechanics of why our days were like they were, and his job was to explain, as he said, that certain people in his patients just went into almost hibernation in the wintertime. So we wrote a small paper on that. It should be somewhere. I don't know.
Well, you were ahead of your time in many ways. And the gardening, I was thinking, the village of Tanacross historically had a large community garden.
Yes.
But again, maybe introduced by miners. I don't know how it came about.
There was some sort of gold rush people who stayed and made Alaska sort of like where they came from as best they could. We have now possibilities to burn our scrap black spruce and heat greenhouses. They're doing this down in the
down near Tok, aren't they?
Tok. It's working out quite well. It requires some maintenance and furnishing vegetables for school children, and working out real well. It's things that can be done. Chena Hot Springs has been fortunate enough to get the funding and the fiscal problems solved to come up with a solution to their energy problems based on the warmth of the water of the hot spring.
Using geothermal.
Yeah.
So in the villages you worked in with the gardening, do you remember, can you talk about one that was successful and one that wasn't?
Yes, well, it had to do with the size of the garden, generally the size of the village. If it was large enough, it seemed much easier than the smaller villages. The smaller villages seemed to be more hunter-gatherer oriented, and they clinged to the idea of, I'm a hunter-gatherer, and I don't need to farm. There has been in our culture, I don't know where it came from, I think it must have stemmed from New Jersey, the word farmer meant, if you weren't able to do anything else, you'd have to be a farmer. Most of our country were farmers not too many years ago. But in some citified settings now, farmer is derogatory. And it spread too far. Because farmers have to work very hard sometimes. Sometimes they sit in an office and mostly use the computers to figure out where things go.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was that like as a non-native going into these villages, introducing this foreign idea to them of gardening? How did that work?
It took a little maneuvering. don't go into a village and say you're from the government, you come to help them. And don't talk too much. Use illustrations. State what you can do from a practical standpoint of giving them a start. Seed, fertilizer, instructions. And you've got to sell these things in such a way that it doesn't seem to interrupt their normal lives. The people in the villages are often quite busy. Mm-hmm. And it's a burden on their time. And gardening requires a good bit of time and patience. You have to go to the absolute basics. When carrots come up, a person who's never seen a carrot come up and what it looked like will pull it up as a weed. I've seen this happen in many villages, that what you had planted to these people looked as weeds and were often uprooted. So you had to be on the spot throughout the planting season and up to harvest. Harvesting what you grew was also a part of the learning, that you had things could get mature in a period when they should be harvested, or they could go beyond and become less desirable, or in some cases inedible. The coal crops were easily done. The cabbage, broccoli, stuff like this, turnips, rutabagas. They were fairly easily raised. And again, you have to figure about nutrition and the cooking. Zucchini can be raised by the ton, as everyone knows. But zucchini can be made into delicious puddings and sweet dessert dishes. And that's one way to fool people into eating it. But it needs to be carried from the very beginning when you meet these folks to talk to them all the way through. And as Dr. Scarlin says, be prepared to spend 20 years on it.
So did you spend 20 years on it?
I spent quite a few, and I don't think 20. I turned it over to a native person, and he changed it. He did some improving and some areas he didn't keep up. But it's something now that many of the natives know how to do. And many natives knew how to garden before the Tanana chiefs started their gardening project. And they were often enlisted to help
carrying
the program forward.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like it was a successful program?
I did. There may be ups and downs. There were literally tons of potatoes raised. They're quite easy to raise.
Yeah.
They keep fairly well. And the so-called Irish potato was, I like to point out to the native people that Native Americans propagated the potato in the Andes. You can go there today and get purple and pink potatoes and all sorts of old varieties. But you can point out that these potatoes went from the Americas to Europe and fed the Europeans. Not only the European people that lived in Belgium and France and so forth, but it became a monocrop in Ireland, where this is what the people depended upon. One of Van Gogh's more famous paintings was The Potato Eaters, people sitting around a table eating potatoes. And it was all that people had to eat for a while, and it made things possible in Europe that wouldn't have been had the potato not been brought there.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy in Ireland was that eventually the climate of Ireland and the environment of the soil and such, that it was easily possible to get a plague in and eradicate the potatoes in 1 year.
So how long did you work for Tanana Chiefs then?
I don't remember exactly.
Did you do other things for them besides the gardening project?
Yes, I did certain things. They called me out on certain things regarding river flooding. I was called to Manly after the end of the rotor shot a bunch of people. I was called because I had studied hydrology, river currents and so forth. And I was put in a boat and rowed around to try to help find bodies and predict where bodies might be found. I pointed out one area that indeed did result in a body being found there. But I never spoke 10 words at this gathering. I resisted any impulse to pontificate about how knowledgeable I was about rivers. And I hope I was respected for that.
Mm-hmm.
But there were times when I was called, as a geographer, to say, is this feasible, possible, or we try it?
Mm-hmm.
I helped design water power from the river for lifting irrigation water. I designed a food processing building and greenhouse combination where power from the water from the rivers would power water up into the greenhouse and also produce a modicum of electricity. Most of what I proposed was a surficial water wheel kind of trapping. They have developed turbines that go beneath the water and use the energy in the river. And that way's, I still have drawings of some of the things that I designed, but I don't know where they are right now.
Well, that's pretty neat that you designed those kinds of things. That's neat that you designed those kinds of devices.
Well, and hopefully the ideas, even though they were presented pretty crudely by me, could have been taken by engineers and perfected and different models tried and prototypes made and so forth.
Yeah, I think of all that as engineers, not that a geographer would start by doing the design. Yeah. So how many years did you work for Tanana Chiefs?
I'm trying to remember. It wasn't but about 3 years, I think. It wasn't a long time.
No. And then what did you go on to do?
That's when I went to work for Arctic Gas, I believe. That didn't last long. It was, I guess, about a 6-month duration. But it fell through, and suddenly, I don't know, they called me from Anchorage and said, they're moving the cabinets, file cabinets out of here, and we owe you money. And I said, well, send it alone.
And so then what did you do? Now you didn't have a job. What did you do?
I'm not sure. Get my time periods mixed up here. Or have a brain freeze.
Did you go back to doing map cartography and scientific illustration?
No.
Did you always do that map work and illustration on the side? Were you always doing that?
I did some illustrations, but just picked them up here and there. Mm-hmm.
So you didn't do it professionally?
I did consulting work for even road feasibility studies regarding the building roads beside eroding rivers, which they had on the Taylor Highway. I did some work with Alyeska, actually, of the problem they would have in river crossings. Some of the riverbeds were many feet of boulders through which, in some cases, a majority of the flow of the rivers was below the bed of the river. Hmm. What you saw was not half of the river. And this proved out that after several lines were crossed, rivers, and they floated to the surface, they found that that was indeed the case. But there were different things that I was called on to do. Someone asked me when I retired, and I couldn't say, because I don't remember any such ceremony.
Well, you didn't have a regular, like if you'd still been teaching at the university, you would have had a faculty position that you retired from.
Yeah.
Sounds like you were kind of working here, there, and everywhere.
I only worked about 5.5 years at the university.
Right. That was in the early 60s, right?
From 62 to 67, actually.
Well, that's why I'm asking what other things you did. And Sounds like you were involved in lots of different things.
I guess I was, in a sense, yeah. And there were times when I didn't have much of an income. I had some wounds and injuries during World War II that I deferred to collect my disability for 4 to 7 years. I paid my own way through college. I didn't use any GI Bill benefits. But it was in about 1993 or 94, along there somewhere, that I figured getting up into age, I might predecease my wife so that if I did, I would want her to have gotten some of my disability payments, mm-hmm. which I hadn't gotten by my own doing. So I applied for disability and was granted disability. But I figured I did it right, I guess, because when I was able to take care of myself, I wanted to take care of myself. My wife was always willing to and wanted to work. She didn't want to stay in the house and wash dishes. That was always a very harmonious situation.
And you said she was your stenographer. She typed up all your
papers
and things.
I wouldn't have been nearly as famous if she hadn't.
And so did she go and get a job as a paid stenographer someplace?
Yes. Uh-huh. She was in charge of the stenographer pool at the university. And so she distributed stenographers around about wherever they were needed, and she was in charge of that, and she enjoyed it thoroughly.
Nowadays, each department has its own staff. They don't share like that.
Well, when I was studying in the university, the departments had their own stenographers that professors wrote out in longhand, generally on legal pads, mm-hmm. hand that to the secretary or the stenographer, and they did it. And they were trained to properly footnote things and do it in acceptably academic fashion. And speaking of the geography of, I have a book here that I'd like to remark on.
Okay.
It might clarify some of my thinking.
Okay.
It's Education in the North. And it was done about 1972 and edited by Frank Darnell. Frank Darnell. The front piece is of Wales.
The Village of Wales?
Of Wales, and it...
The Village of Wales?
Yes, the Village of Wales. And it's pretty desolate looking, but that's pretty well the way it was. But this was the first international conference on cross-cultural education in the circumpolar nations. This included Finland, Norway, Sweden, the Soviet Union, and the United States, represented by Alaska and Canada. So, in all these papers, these different artists, different editors, they're Soviet papers, they're Finnish papers, and they're Swedish papers, and so forth, Canadian, U.S. They talk mainly about the impact of a foreign culture onto the indigenous people. One of the people involved in this was George Rogers. Mm-hmm. And he was an economic geographer, and he stayed in Southeast most of his life, or a big portion of his life. A very excellent academician. He referred to the economics of the things, the impacts, but not one of these papers gives the reasons why circumpolar regions are as unique as they are.
And do you have an answer to that question of why they are?
In other words, I guess what I'm saying here, and these people were writing papers and I wasn't, so I'm not belittling them, but their attempt to explain all the things away, no mention of months of darkness. No mention of a geographic fact, and certainly no explanation of how that affected the European types who went in to teach in these environments. They do say that they brought in their culture and attempted to change the indigenous person to their way of thinking. They were trained to teach, perhaps in Salt Lake City, or Des Moines, or wherever, and they were sent into a place where it was dark. Like, I was sent to Alaska. I was hired by the University of Alaska to begin work on the 18th of January, 1962. And I was ignorant of the short days and cold temperatures. I'm driving up to Seattle in a Volkswagen microbus, kept hearing reports of 50 degrees below zero in Fairbanks. I couldn't imagine what that was like. I got to the airport, it was dark. Dr. Scarlin carried me to my apartment in Fairview Manor. Tiny little one-bedroom thing for the four of us. He had filled my shelves with canned goods because he didn't want me to have the sticker shock going to the store for the first time. But I was moving into an environment that I didn't know. I began teaching courses that my predecessor had taught. Luckily, they were of Latin America, Central America, in some measure, not altogether. But those were the areas that I had studied most intensely. So I was able to pick up those courses, and they were the regional geography of these areas. But then I began to realize where I was, and so I began to appreciate the geographic training that Dr. Scarlin had. Mm-hmm. He was a geographer as well as an anthropologist.
Yeah, I have always wondered that at this university here in Fairbanks, it seems like they don't always have people who are focused on the histories and cultures of this region. Yeah, they're studying Mesoamerica or Russia. Well, Russia's maybe closer, but...
We come from all over.
Yeah.
Now, I think I remember in the yearbooks at Lathrop High, under your picture, there was a state listed where you came from. I don't know whether I'm right on that or not.
Yeah, but that this university should focus more on teaching about Alaska than
teaching
about other places. And I think it's gotten better.
Well, yes, when I left with Dr. Rauchy, I left to a couple of courses, and one was paleogeography, and that was, in other words, Pleistocene geography. And then the geography of the Soviet, and the Soviet North, Northeast, mm-hmm. and the geography of Canada, which... I don't think I left much material for the geography of Canada, because I figured that that was extant and available, which it was. But I left in 67, I believe.
Yeah, 66 or 67, somewhere in there.
And Dr. Rauchy, his wife was had a doctorate in English, and she had hired on before he did. She was a great help in the English department.
So what else did you do in terms of your work? You said you didn't really write very many papers.
I didn't have an awful lot of time. I taught so many different courses until I was physically exhausted, mm-hmm. staying up at night writing out lectures.
Yeah, I was thinking after you left the university, you know, when you were at Tanana Chiefs or teaching your classes at Fort Wainwright or whatever else you did next. I don't know what you did next.
I'm not sure I remember what I did next. I must have done something right. I'm still here.
Yeah, but you didn't spend your time writing papers.
Uh-huh.
You were doing other things, I guess.
Yeah. We were running out of film. Yeah.
Well, I would like to talk to you about your painting, but I want to change the tape.
Yeah.
Before we move into that.
Yeah.
Okay?